For those listening to KSBN Money Talk Radio who might be interested in buying physical precious metals for less than what I can pay for them, stay tuned. I have a way you can support this show and secure what I believe is the best price for precious metals on the existing market. In our first commercial break, I will explain this in more detail. And now, let's get on with Reclaiming the Republic. Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This is G.R. Mobley. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. If you go to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org, you can download our podcast and support documents and links. This is an educational grassroots program designed to restore the Republic and placing the general government, or what many refer to as the federal government, back into the constitutional framework and scope of the Constitution. The number to call in if you want to join the conversation or just spout off, it is 844-320-4299. Again, that's 844-320-4299. Many parts of these shows will refer to previous shows, and I go through this at the beginning of every show just so you understand that this show is related and connects to previous shows and subsequent shows. So to stay abreast with all the content that I put onto the air, you'll need to listen to all of these shows. And so if you haven't heard previous shows or you want to hear subsequent shows that you may not be able to get to, then go to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org and download the podcast. That way you can kind of stay abreast with what we're talking about. This way you can learn about Republic Review and how we can reclaim the Republic. For a local announcement, I know that the Spokane GOP is hosting their Lincoln Day dinner on June 3rd, and I'm trying to get some details regarding that. And so I've not been very aggressive in trying to find out some more of the details on that, but you can get your tickets before they're gone. First and foremost, this last weekend, I had a great opportunity to speak to a large group of patriots who were exercising communications and organizational operations out in the field. And I mean field, that's literally nature. It was great to see so many good patriots engaged in the fundamental constitutional principles that founded this republic. As I spoke to the body of these patriots, it once again was refreshing to see more good people become optimistic towards a true message of hope that we can actually save our Constitution. For that, I want to publicly thank those who attended last weekend and for their patriotism. I also want to thank their leadership for allowing me to come out there and joining them, and regarding the opportunity to give my message of auditing the Constitution with Republic Review. With that, let's move into the real quick purview of the past week's constitutional events. Just when we thought the national GOP version of socialized medicine was dead on arrival, it appears that Speaker Ryan, who was excoriated by many, has been able to get wind in his sails and now is going to make a better attempt to put a national GOP branding on socialized medicine. Apparently, the state's suits at the beginning of Obamacare and the promise to repeal over the last 7 years holds no water with nationalism. As I have said for years, the general government will not, I repeat, will not relinquish any unconstitutional powers without the states asserting their authority first. This is why going through the Federalist Papers and the ratification debates are so important, and that's why I'm dying of paper cuts so that you won't have to. In another news item this week, a San Francisco federal judge, Judge Richard Seaborg, said on Monday that the standard used by the Department of Homeland Security's program to identify possible terror activity was legally adopted and not by arbitrary use of power, and therefore he dismissed the case that was brought forth by the ACLU. So to do what they're doing, they have to spy on Americans without us knowing so that they can create an unconstitutional database to be able to predict terrorist types of activities and potential profiles. So the question is, was the ACL lawsuit a ruse, or was this a real legitimate lawsuit that they were really trying to stop the federal government from data collecting and basically violating our rights? So I believe it was a ruse. And if one looks at the ACLU, this is a subversive legal entity that is designed and funded to chip away at our true liberty with the intent of empowering the state with the powers of enforcing the progressive agenda. In this case, this lawsuit was intended to fail and bolster up state powers by setting precedents. Remember, this case was tried and dismissed in San Francisco. San Francisco courts, and this court is not, or actually is, a bastion of progressivism and not a bastion of liberty. It is a progressive stronghold that is working to take away our liberties and discard our Constitution. In context to this issue, the Department of Homeland Security, as I've said many times, is unconstitutional unless someone can find the amendment to the Constitution where the states delegated this power to the federal government. And a real quick message and an aside from this, I hear that the city of Seattle is suing the federal government for violating the Constitution. And it's interesting that they're choosing immigration, actually one of those few powers delegated to it by the federal government in Article 1, Section 8, that they are to put into order or to regulate and standardize immigration. And I'm going, you know, it's one thing if you wanted to go after them for administering welfare. If it's another thing if you wanted to go after them for the Department of Justice or all 12 of the unconstitutional executive departments, but you're going to go after them for the thing that's actually listed in the Constitution? Anywho, in context to this whole issue of Seattle suing them, it seems like this is just another one of those distractions. Anyway, back on track. To support my assertion regarding the unconstitutionality of the Department of Homeland Security and those 12 different executive departments, I am going to be getting into the Madison's veto of the bonus bill. It was an March 17, 1817 veto that was done by Madison and his admonishment to Congress how they could not assume and usurp the powers of the states by creating what at that point in time was the framework for the Department of Transportation. So in a future show, I'll be going into that. But by all means, if you want to look it up, it is Madison's veto, March 17th, 1817. Okay, so what I'm trying to do with these Federalist Papers and so forth is going through a chronological order by date in which is the first or the first thing that really occurred that completed first was the Federalist Papers. Now, there were some ratification debates that started, like Pennsylvania, started before the Federalist Papers did, but it actually didn't end until after the Federalist Papers. So I just figured, let me do the concise wrap on the Federalist Papers, then I'll get into the different states' ratification debates. As far as Madison and that particular veto that you may want to go read because it was March 17, 1817, what Madison did was he closed the door on the idea that the federal government could use any clause in the Constitution to usurp any new role, responsibility, or power. So not only are these departments, but many of the offices, agencies, and administrations, such as like the FBI, and so forth. There's 580 some odd different departments, offices, agencies, and so forth. And most all of them are unconstitutional. So if you've been listening to this program and followed my show, and if you actually followed up my show by reading the Federalist Papers, and read them in context for yourself, these things that I've cited on the show, then I'm confident that you understand and agree and support my assertions. On the other hand, if you have progressive leanings, then you would completely deny everything the framers stated as fact, which means you support the progressive principles and a living constitution. And I'll finish this thought because our bumper music's here, and I just ask that you stay tuned, and we'll get into the Federalist Papers in just a few. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. You will find consistent advice among financial advisors, conservative entertainers, preppers, and those who have legitimate concern about our currency and our government. They all recommend holding precious metals in some way and degree for varying reasons. I, too, recommend precious metals, especially holding it in your possession in a secure storage system for several reasons. One, it can protect you from the inflation of a fiat currency. Two, some coins can be used in bartering in an absolute emergency. And three, this is a good way to pass wealth down to your posterity. If you're looking to add precious metals to your portfolio or to your holdings, I would like to show you how you can get these metals for less than how I can get them. You heard that correct, for less than how I can get them. And I believe you cannot beat this price. Let me explain. My broker's company has, I believe, the lowest set price for all metals on the market. And just like all other precious metal companies, they offer commission to those who refer others, which most times this affects the bottom line price. Well, my broker's company does not adjust the price. They have a flat buy and selling price. And I have worked it out with my broker to take a portion of my commission to offer you a discount to let you save money on your purchases for slightly lower than the price, than the selling price that I get them for. It may be a slight discount, but a discount nonetheless. If you're interested in buying physical metals at the lowest price and learning more about this deal, contact me via email at metals, with an S at the end, at reclaimingtherepublic.org, and I will introduce you to my broker, and he can give you the pricing and how you will actually pay less than me. Again, that's metals, M-E-T-A-L-S, at reclaimingtherepublic.org. Thank you. Okay, so at the end of last segment, I was starting to talk about the progressives who may have leaning tendencies and would probably completely deny everything that the framers stated as fact. So let me finish this thought. That means that the progressives, those progressives that might be listening, you're supporting the progressive principles of a living constitution that the federal government can whimsically change or do anything they feel is necessary. Now remember, Seattle is a very progressive city, and those are progressives that are running that city. So they have this context that as long as it's a progressive in charge, they're okay with these whimsical tyrannies and oppressions that they throw out, whether that be refugee programs or what have you. But when the federal government isn't doing that, then that's bad. But the overall paradigm of the progressive is that the federal government is a noble, principled government with the authority to do whatever it needs to do. But all of a sudden, if it's not led by progressives, then it's all, they're challenging the constitutionality. This is a very entertaining ride. So let me say this again, and I've said this a couple of times, and I'll say this a lot. All of these things are a part of the distraction. They are intending on getting you engaged in a tactical fight. They want you to go out and follow your passion and go get involved in one of these distractions. That distraction could be immigration. It could be the refugees. It could be abortion. You pick the problem du jour, because there's multiple problems every day of federal tyranny, and it's a very wide range. If you go to the Mobius Strip Press website, MobiusStripPress.com. I have one of my presentations, and one of those slides on my presentation that I gave last July at the Constitution Association when I was the keynote speaker down in Southern California, that slide of this multi-armed monster, that's the Leviathan, and that is the federal government with all these unconstitutional arms and appendages. So go take a look at that and figure out what arm you want to wrestle, because as long as you're engaging in one issue and one issue at a time, or maybe two or three, it doesn't matter. If you're not engaging the beast directly, then you'll never be able to kill the beast in a single battle. And as a matter of fact, we're losing the war because it's laughing at us, because we're not working together to kill the beast. And the way to kill the beast is, again, through republic review and auditing the Constitution. This is why I always say it's not about a single issue like abortion, immigration, refugees, or what have you. The real problem that we have to fight is the compliance to the Constitution and getting the federal government or the general government into scope and the framework of the Constitution and doing what they're supposed to do for us. Folks, we're under siege of a few different types of wars here, whether you want to admit it or not. The most important war we're fighting is over our individual liberties and sovereignty, and what is at stake is our Constitution in this republic. The solution is simple, as I've said it before, and I'll just keep on repeating this, that we have to execute republic review, or in other words, getting the states to audit the Constitution. Another war we're fighting, whether we like it or not, is a religious war, and the secular progressives are using the Islamists as tools. How are they tools? The progressives know that the Islamists are a no-compromise religion, just like the progressives are. They're no compromise. It's always sliding down their slope. That's the direction we will always go, and that's the direction we've been going for the past century. As the Islamists wage their war here, just like Europe and everywhere else they go, the progressives are trying to set us up so that we become willing to surrender our liberties and our religious freedoms. This is an old progressive tactic that Dr. Robert Higgs discusses in his book, Crisis and Leviathan, where the progressives create a problem designed with the intended solution to get us to surrender that particular liberty. Another book that I read that speaks the exact same thing is The Unseen Hand by Dr. A. Ralph Epperson. Over time, they slowly ratchet us down, taking away our liberties until we have surrendered either enough of our liberties or all of them to where they can subjugate us, or in other words, enslave us to the state. This is also known as the boiling the frog syndrome. They do it very slowly so that we're not aware of what they're doing. So let me invite you to read my book as I make this case in my book. Or, better yet, you can read Ludwig von Mises' Socialism and a few of his books. Or you can read Friedrich Hayek's The Road to Serfdom and a few of his books. And Robert Higgs's books. There are many authors and books out there to expose this insidious strategy that has been used in every society before this one. The good news here, folks, is that we can break this destructive cycle, but the world is dependent on us, the hybrid constitutional republic, commonly referred to as the United States. We must lead the way out. And once again, we can do it as I've told you, all we have to do is get the states to assert their authority and audit the Constitution. I know this is a foreign concept, and it takes a while for many people to get their arms around this, but I've yet to have a constitutional scholar tell me that's not constitutional. You can't do that. I have lots of people that have their vested programs of education or what have you, and I'm not saying that we can't be educated, and I'm trying to educate as a part of this program, but we don't have time to educate the entire electorate. And one of the conversations I had with a constitutional scholar and a former prosecuting attorney and what do they call those guys? The chief attorney for Texas, the state of Texas, the general attorney, I think. Anyway. He basically, agreed with my premise, but he says that we can't, execute that until we've educated everybody. Then I asked him, and I ask everybody this, how much time do you think we have? Because it took Moses 40 years to change a culture. Are you saying we're going to have to spend 40 years in changing our culture? Do you think we have that much time? And the inevitable answer always is, no, we don't really have that much time. We're way too far down this path. And I said, then what is your suggestion if we can't educate everybody? And then they kind of give me this dumb stare, and I go, so what you're saying is Republic review and auditing the Constitution is our only hope. And then sometimes they'll reluctantly nod, or they'll go, wow, education. Anyway, sometimes it's the immovable object and the irresistible force. Anyway, moving on. Last week I had Mark Erbach on, who's a former public school teacher, author, and so forth. We first spoke about my thesis of reeling in the court, that Trump doesn't have to complain anymore. He can reel in the court with a Judiciary Act and force the federal court systems to stay within their jurisdiction of the Constitution and the constitutional confines only. But the problem with this, and I don't think this will ever happen, because they won't write it, because that they would have to recognize that 80% of what they're doing is unconstitutional. If they reel in the court, they'd have to reel themselves in. So it's not a paradox, folks, but it is the reality that they'll never do the right thing. We have to assert our authority as states and force them in doing the right thing. So anyway, what we're not able to get into over the past century, while the federal courts have asserted its authority over religion and secularism, as far as Mark and my conversation last week. So I'm hoping to have him on next week to do a follow-up. And what I've asked him to do is to basically list out the court cases so that you can pay note, download the podcast, so you can go and get these court cases yourself, and then see what I have been asserting for years, that the federal government has violated the First Amendment's Establishment Clause. They've actually created a national secular church. Oh, well, surprise, surprise, another 10 minutes has gone by. I will get back into this violation of the First Amendment Clause as soon as we get back, because I'm sure your ears have perked up and have piqued your interest. So stay tuned, and I will talk to you about this national church that the federal government set up under our nose. So those of you that didn't drive into the ditch, and those of you that haven't had any accidents and is fixing broken bones or stopping the bleeding and treating for shock, what I said right before the break is that in speaking with Mark, and one of the things that I want to kind of flush out is how the federal court system not only stopped our religious freedoms and our expressions, but they basically began enforcing secularism upon us. And in doing so, what they have done is they have violated the First Amendment Establishment Clause, which means the federal government is not supposed to create a church. Well, technically, they didn't build a building. They didn't put, you know, this great big edifice up and say, okay, everybody has to come and attend. What they did was they created a religion on principle of secularism. And this religion, as a matter of fact, this isn't my idea. I actually first heard this and I started, you know, connecting things when I read Free to Choose by Milton Friedman back in the 80s. And I'd heard other people making these same assertions. And that was back in the 80s. That was long before transgender bathrooms and all of these other issues of the day, where the secular state is now dictating what our moral standards are going to be. You can't locally dictate this. The national government is going to. And they're, you know, slowly ratcheting this down our throats. And so if you understand what the framers created, they created a non-denominational federal government. Non-denominational meaning that it was not to take up any denomination of Christianity. But putting that to the side, if you read Federalist Paper Number 2 by John Jay, and I will cite it one of these days. I won't have it today. But he talks about the nation at that time, or the republic at that time, was pretty much one type of people, one religion, and so forth in the 13 states. If I remember correctly, the only state that really had some divergence was like Pennsylvania with some Germans. I think that was the only state that published the Constitution in a different language other than English. They actually, I think, printed like 1,200 or something like that in German. But most all the states were predominantly English, Christians of different faiths and so forth. And so when the United States formed from the Constitution, they maintained the same Christian standards. And I really mean Christian standards, because a lot of people, and this came out today in this conversation, so I wanted to elucidate or help illuminate this issue for you, that when a person went to court, they were unable to testify if they were not a Christian in good standing in their community. I'm not making this up. You can go and read this out of Alexis de Tocqueville's Democracy in America. Not only that, but if you read Joseph Story's bio, he defends the fact that we couldn't allow infidels into our court system. It was very common for the minister or whomever to verify the veracity of the witnesses that would be taking the stand and testifying that they were good Christians in good standing. A little unknown fact that I didn't share earlier today, but I will now. In Dumas Malone's 6 books that he published on Thomas Jefferson, he noted that when Jefferson was being tried for abandoning his post as a war governor, the oncoming governor was a little bit insulted that he wasn't there for him. And so the new governor basically pressed charges, and once the war was over, they had a small little hearing to determine if Jefferson truly did violate the court, or I should say the law, by not being present. And long story short, the travel circuit judge comes in, Jefferson's there, the few officers of the court are there, they're just going to have this quick hearing, and the judge calls Jefferson up to the bench and says, "Mr. Jefferson, I understand that you're not a Christian in good standing." I'm paraphrasing here. He says, "I understand you're not a Christian in good standing in your community. Therefore, I will not allow you to bear testimony in my court. However, because you're an officer of this court, I'll allow you to cross-examine and ask questions, but you cannot bear testimony." And that goes into what Joseph Story was saying, that it was just common that if you weren't in good standing in church and an upstanding citizen in your community and church, that they just wouldn't trust you. They wouldn't trust your testimony. And so that, I believe, is one of the things that got into Jefferson's craw, that he felt, you know, that's unfair. It's not that he wasn't a good person. And so I can get into some of my speculation on why he wrote that letter and why he took some of the positions he took regarding religion. And I think in some respects, it may have caused some problems, or I think the fruit of what he did was, you know, ended up turning bad. But anyway, let me get back to the fact that what the federal government is doing today in our Constitution and with what they're asserting in secularism is an outright blatant violation of the Constitution. They cannot be stepping on our religious freedoms of expression. Never were they able to do that. And Mark flushed that out in his book. And so what I would do is I'd recommend you getting Mark's book. It's called Believe, and it's on my website on the podcast page. If you want to go, the links are there to Amazon where you can buy the book. Now, before I get into my next citation and kind of close out on this, you know, secularism, this is another one of those distractions. I believe that this can get fixed. I believe all of these things that the federal government is doing will get fixed once we get them back into the scope of the Constitution. And again, how's that? That's right. auditing. Auditing the Constitution is the only way we'll be able to do this. So before I get into my first citation, and we're well into the show at this point, one of my favorite questions, and I've got to go through this, are the words in these founding documents that I'm citing here today, which are clearly documented, are these the words of deceit? Or are the words that we have been taught from our progressive education system, the progressive colleges, the progressive professors, lawyers, politicians, and bureaucrats, the words of deceit? Who can we trust? What is the truth as to how our Constitution is defined? And that's the question I pose to you. So 2 weeks ago, before I had Mark on, because we weren't able to go through any of the Federalist Papers last week, but 2 weeks ago we were, and I just want to kind of brush over these. The first one was Federalist Paper 26, paragraph 9, Alexander Hamilton, who said, state legislatures will always be vigilant and jealous guardians of the rights of the citizens against encroachments from the federal government. What happened? What happened to our state legislatures? Why aren't they vigilant and jealous guardians over our rights and guarding us against these encroachments? What happened? He also said not only would they be the voice, but then, if necessary, the arm of their discontent. Okay. Sometimes when I read Hamilton, because I know how he was a real pro-centrist and a pro-nationalist and wanted to marginalize the state legislatures. So when I read some of these things, I just think maybe he was grandstanding. But Madison echoed these same sentiments. And that was truly the intent, and this was the dialogue that was stated. But what they were saying here was the truth, that the state legislatures did have the power and they were going to be able to basically use whatever necessary to show their discontent, whether it be the arm or voice. The next one was another Hamilton Federalist Paper, number 31, paragraph 12, confining our attention wholly to the nature and extent of the powers they are delineated in the Constitution. Why was he saying that? Because don't worry about the things that they're not going to be doing. Only worry about the stuff that we delineated in the Constitution. Well, look at what's happened today. They're doing well beyond what's been delineated. The state governments will have the advantage, and this is Federalist Paper number 45, Madison, paragraph 7. The state government will have the advantage of the federal government, whether we compare them in respect to the immediate dependence of one or the other. What is that advantage? That advantage is because of the stakeholders and the owners of this Constitution and the contract, that they have the authority to basically step in and say, you're violating the contract, get back. Get back into scope that we've delegated to you, or we'll have to force you by doing that, cutting you off from funding or whatever necessary. The state and the final one that we went through 2 weeks ago was Federalist Paper number 17, Alexander Hamilton, paragraph 13. And you download the podcast and you can replay these. The state governments generally possess the confidence and goodwill of the people and will be able to effectually oppose all encroachments of the national government. Interesting. And interesting, there's this music. So going into my last break, please stay tuned. We're going to get right back into the Federalist Papers, and we're going to start off with Federalist Paper 48. I'll be right back. Thank you. And we're back. And actually, on that note of growth and extending our broadcasting, I believe within the next, because we just started in February, so it's only been 2 months, but it looks like we will probably be picking up a few extra radio stations throughout the state or throughout the general area. And so you may want to jump on that. Anyway, this first Federalist Paper, like I said, is Federalist Paper number 48, and it's James Madison, and I'm citing from paragraph 16 here. The conclusion which I am warranted in drawing from these observations is that the mere demarcation on parchment of the constitutional limits of the several departments is not a sufficient guard against these encroachments, which lead to a tyrannical concentration of all the powers of government in the same hands. So what Madison had just said is that just making a demarcation on parchments in the Constitution or even in the state constitutions or within the state legislatures of just putting it down on paper that they're not going to do this, they won't do this, that's not enough. You have to be vigilant and look at everything it is they're doing and the intended consequences and sometimes the unintended consequences of what they are doing. Because a lot of times there are the unintended consequences that can be horrific. Moving on to this next one, and this is a interesting one because it's Federalist Paper 78, paragraph 16 by Alexander Hamilton. If then the courts of justice are to be limited, considered, or are to be considered as the bulwarks of a limited constitution against legislative encroachments, this consideration will afford a strong argument for the permanent tenure of judicial offices, since nothing will contribute to so much as this to be independent spirit in the judges, which must be essential to the faithful performance of so arduous a duty. My, how things have changed since Hamilton had written that. We now see long-term appointments and have become rats for nesting of corruption. And to me, this speaks of an importance of easing the impeachments of judges instead of giving them protected tenure. In this next citation, which is another Hamilton citation, this one creates, this is where Hamilton creates a straw man argument about a phantom. He uses the word phantom. And I believe at this point, or sometime beyond this, or I should say before this, and in the ratification process is where Hamilton probably recognized how to exploit the Constitution by using the judiciary to inject case law precedents and judicial review to undermine the Constitution to facilitate the centralizing of powers via an unconstitutional process. Let me give you some background on this, because if you understand Hamilton and his shenanigans that he employed with Adams, Hamilton was still in the government as a department secretary, and Jefferson was still in the government, but he was the vice president. And because his only role was to play the president of the Senate and the vote breaker, a lot of times he didn't have anything to do. And so he basically went back to Monticello or was adrift. And Hamilton was very close and had Adams' ear and was able to, because Hamilton was an active lawyer. Now, don't get me wrong, Adams was a lawyer too, but he was a lawyer up in Massachusetts. And if you go and look at the lawyers that were being seated as judges, the majority of the lawyers that were being seated were from the central area and the southern areas, not very many from the very north where Adams was. And if you think about it, Adams came back from being an emissary and wasn't really involved too much in Massachusetts law and the northeastern law area. So he may not have known a lot of people or didn't want to burden them with public service. So he was happy to pick up and take on Hamilton's suggestions of midnight judges and filling all these seats. And so Hamilton was very busy in getting those who he trusted, and Marshall was very much one of those who he trusted, and he was Marshall's mentor, and Marshall was his protege, and Marshall actually came out in a biography and talked about Hamilton and the influence that he had. And so, I believe, The book is at the tip of my tongue and it evades me at this point, but I do know that there's a philosophical book that talked about Marshall confessing that, you know, it was Hamilton who, you know, kind of showed him the light of how the court could use its judicial review and centralizing powers and overreaching itself. Now, he didn't call it overreaching, but you could see that, you know, it was Hamilton that influenced him, and he credited Hamilton for that. So let me get into the Federalist paper. It may, in the last place, be observed that the supposed danger of judiciary encroachments on the legislative authority, which has been upon many occasions reiterated, is really a phantom. In other words, he's saying, well, you guys are just making this up. This is, you know, you're making a straw man argument when actually he's proposing a straw man argument against their legitimate argument. Particular misconstructions, going back to Hamilton, what he said, particular misconstructions and contraventions of the will of the legislature may now and then happen, but may now and then happen, now and again happen, I guess is in today's vernacular. But they can never be so extensive as to the amount to an inconvenience or in any sensible degree to affect the order of the political system. This may be inferred with certainty from the general nature of the judicial power, from the objects to which it relates, from the manner in which it is exercised, from its comparative weakness, and from its total incapacity to support its usurpations by force. He makes a great argument here, but what happened? We can clearly see that as soon as Marshall took over, Marshall actually started legislating from the bench and started injecting case law, and it just got crazy in the 1900s with Hugo Black and all of these things that Mark Urbach was talking about, where they were literally asserting progressive agendas into law and ramming this down our throat. Remember, Blackmun in the Roe v. Wade decision basically cited emanations from penumbras. Do you know what a penumbra is? A penumbra is a part of a solar eclipse. The umbra is the complete blackout or the shadow. The penumbra is the faint shadow. And go look it up. And then, so he was basically saying that there was these rays of emanations within these penumbras that kind of lent to this concept of individual freedom within the Constitution. What? And Blackmun was appointed by Nixon, and supposedly Nixon was, what, a conservative Republican? We really need to vet our politicians much better, and especially at the local level. I can tell you that if we start picking constitutional politicians that use the Constitution as a weapon and as a shield in protecting us and going out and fighting the progressive fight, then I truly believe that we will finally find politicians that are serving us. And those that will use the Constitution will not hesitate to step forward and either petition, if they're a local politician, like the Spokane City Council. We need to get constitutionalists in there, folks. And if we can do that, then we can get them to petition the state legislatures to do their job and protect us from federal tyranny. I would love to talk to you in great lengths about this, but I only have an hour, and so I'm very limited in what I can do and how much I can do. That's one of the reasons why I've got to kind of mix it up a little bit to let you kind of digest this elephant one bite at a time. So I don't want to give you 20 Federalist Papers. So we got 4 done today. And so I want you to go and kind of read and cogitate and really think with intent. Cogitate and look at what these guys have been saying. They've clearly stated that the states had all the power. The states had the authority to stop any usurpations. And with that, I want you to think about it, because all we've got to do is stand up and do the right thing. I hope you have a great weekend. Come back next week and we'll get into some more, and I'll have Mark Urbach back here. Thank you very much. and have a God-blessed weekend.